to Super Opera Funcast Players presents 12 Angry Men. Brought to you by...
Brought to you by Colgate. Get your teeth clean and also get rid of cavities and Tata Control. Available.
That was Brian from The Family Guy. He died, but he's back for the show to welcome you. This is Jeff Thompson, our first player. He will be playing...
Juror number 3. Juror number 6. And Juror 11.
And Stephen Robles.
Juror number 10. Juror number 4. And juror number 12.
And our narrator and judge and guard,
Laura Menino.
And I will be playing number 2, number 5, number 7, number 8, and number 9. A doozy! Thank you, and enjoy the show.
Act 1. Fade in on a jury box. 12 men are seated in it, listening intently to the voice of the judge as he charges them. We do not see the judge. He speaks in slow, measured tones, and his voice is grave. The camera drifts over the faces of the jurymen as the judge speaks, and we see that most of their heads are turned to cameras left. Number 7 looks down at his hands. Number 3 looks off in another direction, the direction in which the defendant would be sitting. Number 10 keeps moving his head back and forth nervously. The judge drones on. Murder in the first degree, premeditated homicide, is the most serious charge tried in our criminal courts. You've heard a long and complex case, gentlemen, and it is now your duty to sit down and try and separate the facts from the fancy. One man is dead, the life of another is at stake. If there is a reasonable doubt in your minds as to the guilt of the accused, then you must declare him not guilty. If, however, there is no reasonable doubt, then he must be found guilty. Whichever way you decide, the verdict must be unanimous. I urge you to deliberate honestly and thoughtfully. You are faced with a grave responsibility. Thank you, gentlemen. The jury will retire. And now, slowly, almost hesitantly, the members of the jury begin to rise. Awkwardly, they file out of the jury box and off camera to the left. Camera holds on jury box and then fades out. Fade in a large, bare, and pleasant-looking room. This is the jury room in the county criminal court of a large eastern city. It is about 4 p.m. The room is furnished with a long conference table and a dozen chairs. The walls are bare, drab, and badly in need of a fresh coat of paint. Along one wall is a row of windows which look out on the skyline of the city's financial district. High on other wall is an electric clock. A washroom opens off the jury room. In one corner of the room is a water fountain. On the table are pads, pencils, and ashtrays. One of the windows is open. Papers blow across the table and onto the floor as the door opens. Lettered on the outside of the door are the words, Jury Room. A uniformed guard holds the door open. Slowly, almost self-consciously, the 12 jurors file in. The guard counts them as they enter the door, his lips moving, but no sound coming forth. 4 or 5 of the jurors light cigarettes as they enter the room. Juror number 5 lights his pipe, which he smokes constantly throughout the play. Juror number 2 and 12 go to the water fountain. Number 9 goes into the washroom, the door of which is lettered Men. Several of the jurors take seats at the table. Others stand awkwardly around the room. Several look out the windows. These are men who are ill at ease, who do not really know each other, who talk to each other and wish they were anywhere but here. Number 7 standing at the window takes out a pack of gum, takes a piece and offers it around. There are no takers. He mops his brow.
You know something? It's hot. You think they'd at least air condition the place? I almost dropped dead in court.
Number 7 opens the window a bit wider. The guard looks them over and checks his count. Then, satisfied, he makes ready to leave. Okay, gentlemen, everybody's here. If there's anything you want, I'm right outside. Just knock. He exits, closing the door. Silently, they all look at the door. We hear the lock clicking.
I never knew they locked the door.
Sure they locked the door. What did you think?
I don't know. It just never occurred to me.
Some of the jurors are taking off their jackets. Others are sitting down at the table. They still are reluctant to talk to each other. Foreman is at the head of the table tearing slips of paper for ballots. Now we get a close shot of number 8. He looks out the window. We hear number 3 talking to number 2.
6 days. They should have finished it in 2. Talk, talk, talk. Did you ever hear so much talk about nothing?
Oh, I guess they're entitled.
Everybody gets a fair trial. That's the system. Well, I suppose you can't say anything against it.
Number 2 looks at him nervously, nods, and goes over to the water cooler. Cut to shot of number 8 staring out the window. Cut to table. Number 7 stands at the table, puffing out a cigarette.
How did you like that business about the knife? Did you ever hear a phonier story?
Well, you gotta expect that. You know what you're dealing with.
Yeah, I suppose. What's the matter? You got a cold?
Lulu. These hot weather colds can kill you.
All right, gentlemen, let's take our seats.
Right, this better be fast. I've got tickets to the 7-Year Itch tonight. I must be the only guy in the whole world who hasn't seen it yet. Okay, you're on to start the show.
They all begin to sit down. The foreman is seated at the head of the table. Nareet continues to look out the window. How about sitting down? Hey, the gentleman at the window. How about sitting down?
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's tough to figure, isn't it? Kid kills his father. Beep, just like that. Well's the element. They let the kids run wild. Maybe serves them right.
Is everybody here?
The old man's inside.
The foreman turns to the washroom just as the door opens. Number 9 comes out, embarrassed. We'd like to get started.
Forgive me, gentlemen. I didn't mean to keep you waiting.
That's all right. Find a seat. Number 9 heads for a seat and sits down. They all look the foreman expectantly. All right, now you gentlemen can handle this any way you want to. I mean, I'm not going to make any rules. If we want to discuss it first and then vote, that's one way. Or we can vote right now to see how we stand.
Let's vote now. Who knows, maybe we can all go home.
Yeah, let's see who's here.
Right, let's vote now.
All right, anybody doesn't want to vote? Looks around the table, there's no answer. Okay, all those voting guilty, raise your hands. 7 or 8 hands go up immediately. Several others go up more slowly. Everyone looks around the table. There are 2 hands not raised. Number 9's and number 8's. Number 9's hands goes up slowly now as the foreman counts. 9, 10, 11. All right, that's 11 for guilty. Okay, not guilty? Number 8's hand is raised. 1. Right, okay. 11-1 guilty. Now we know where we are.
Somebody's in left field. You think he's not guilty?
I don't know.
I've never saw a guiltier man in my life. You sat right in court and heard the same thing I did. The man's a dangerous killer. You could see it.
He's 19 years old.
That's old enough. He knifed his own father 4 inches into the chest. An innocent little 19-year-old kid. They proved it 12 different ways. Do you want me to list them?
No.
Well, do you believe his story?
I don't know whether I believe it or not. Maybe I don't. So what did you vote not guilty for? There were 11 votes for guilty. It's not so easy for me to raise my hand and send a boy off to die without talking about it first. Who says it's easy for me? No one. What, just because I voted fast, I think the guy's guilty? You couldn't change my mind if you talked for 100 years. I don't want to change your mind. I just want to talk for a while. Look, this boy's been kicked around all his life. You know, living in a slum, his mother dead since he was 9. That's not a very good head start. He's a tough, angry kid. You know why slum kids get that way. Because we knock him on the head once a day, every day. I think maybe we owe him a few words, that's all.
He looks around the table. Some of them look back coldly. Some cannot look at him. Number 9 nods slowly. Number 12 doodles steadily. Number 4 begins to comb his hair.
I don't mind telling you this, mister. We don't owe him a thing. He got a fair trial, didn't he? You know what the trial cost? He's lucky he got it. Look, we're all grown-ups here. You're not going to tell us that we're supposed to believe him knowing what he is. I've lived among them all my life. You can't believe a word they say. You know that.
I don't know that. What a terrible thing for a man to believe. Since when is dishonesty a group characteristic? You have no monopoly on the truth.
All right, it's not Sunday. We don't need a sermon.
What this man says is very dangerous.
Number 8 puts his hand on number 9's arm and stops him. Somehow his touch and his gentle expression calm the old man. He draws a deep breath and relaxes.
I don't see why we need any need for arguing like this. I think we ought to be able to behave like gentlemen.
Right.
If we're going to discuss this case, let's discuss the facts.
I think that's a good point. We have a job to do, let's do it.
If you gentlemen don't mind, I'm going to close the window. It was blowing on my neck.
I have an idea here. I'm just thinking out loud now, but it seems to me that it's up to us to convince this gentleman that we're right and he's wrong. Maybe if we each took a minute or two, you know, if we sort of tried on for size.
Well, that sounds fair enough. Supposing we can go once around the table?
Okay, let's start it off.
Right. I guess you're first.
Oh, well, I just think he's guilty. I thought it was obvious. I mean, nobody proved otherwise. Nobody has to prove otherwise. The burden of proof is on the prosecution. The defendant doesn't even have to open his mouth. That's in the Constitution. The Fifth Amendment. You've heard of it? Well, sure, I've heard of it. I know what it is. Anyway, I think he was guilty.
Okay, let's get to the facts. Number one, let's take the old man who lived on the second floor right underneath the room where the murder took place. At 12:10 on the night of the killing, he heard loud noises in the upstairs apartment. He said it sounded like a fight. Then he heard the kid say to his father, "I'm going to kill you." A second later, he heard a body falling, and he ran to the door of his apartment, looked out, and saw the kid running down the stairs and out of the house. Then he called the police. They found the father with a knife in his chest.
And the coroner fixed the time of death at around midnight.
Right. Now what else do you want?
The boy's entire story is flimsy. He claimed he was at the movies. That's a little ridiculous, isn't it? He couldn't even remember what pictures he saw.
That's right. Did you hear that? You're absolutely right.
Look, what about the woman across the street? If her testimony don't prove it, then nothing does.
That's right. She saw the killing, didn't she?
Let's go in order.
Just a minute. Here's a woman who's lying in bed and can't sleep. It's hot, you know? Anyway, she looks out the window, and right across the street, she sees the kid stick a knife into his father. She's known the kid all his life. His window is right opposite hers, across the L tracks, and she swore she saw him do it.
Through the windows of a passing elevated train.
Okay. And they proved in court that you can see through the windows of a passing L train at night and see what's happening on the other side. They proved it.
I'd like to ask you something. How come you believed her? She's one of them, too, isn't she?
Number 10 walks over to number 8.
You're a pretty smart fella, aren't you?
Now take it easy. Number 3 gets up and goes to number 10.
Come on, sit down. What are you letting him get you upset for? Relax.
Number 10 and number 3 sit down. All right, let's calm down now. Number 5, it's your turn.
I'll pass it.
That's your privilege. How about you?
I don't know. I started to be convinced, you know, with the testimony from those people across the hall. Didn't they say something about an argument between the father and the boy around 7 o'clock that night? I can be wrong. I think that was 8 o'clock, not 7.
That's right, 8 o'clock. They heard the father hit the boy twice and then saw the boy walk angrily out of the house. What does that prove?
Well, it doesn't exactly prove anything. It's just part of the picture. I didn't say it proved anything.
Anything else?
No.
Number 6 goes to the water fountain. All right, how about you?
I don't know. Most of it's been said already. We can talk all day about this thing, but I think we're wasting our time. Look at the kid's record. At 15, he was in reform school. He stole a car. He's been arrested for mugging. He was picked up for knife fighting. I think they said he stabbed somebody in the arm. This is a very fine boy. Ever since he was 5 years old, his father beat him up regularly. He used his fists. So would I, a kid like that.
You're right. It's the kids, the way they are, you know. They don't listen. I got a kid. When he was 8 years old, he ran away from a fight. I saw him. I was so ashamed. I told him right out, "I'm going to make a man out of you, or I'm going to bust you up into little pieces trying." When he was 15, he hit me in the face. He's big, you know. I haven't seen him in 3 years. Rotten kid, you work your heart out. All right, let's get on with it.
We're missing the point here. This boy, let's say he's a product of a filthy neighborhood and a broken home. We can't help that. We're not here to go into the reasons why slums are breeding grounds for criminals. They are. I know it. So do you. The children who come out of slum backgrounds are potential menaces to society.
You said it there. I don't want any part of them, believe me.
There's a dead silence for a moment, and then number 5 speaks haltingly.
I've lived in a slum all my life.
Oh, now wait a second.
I used to play in a backyard that was filled with garbage. Maybe it still smells on me.
All right, now let's be reasonable. There's nothing personal. Number 5 stands up.
There is something personal.
Then he catches himself, and seeing everyone looking at him, sits down, fists clenched.
Come on now, he didn't mean you, fella. Let's not get so sensitive.
There's a long pause.
I can understand this sensitivity.
All right, now let's stop the bickering. We're wasting time. All right, it's your turn.
All right, I had a peculiar feeling about this trial. Somehow I felt that the defense counsel never really conducted a thorough cross-examination. I mean, he was appointed by the court to defend the boy. He hardly seemed interested. Too many questions were left unasked.
What about the questions that were asked? For instance, let's talk about that cute little switch knife. You know, that one that fine, upright kid admitted buying?
All right, let's talk about it. Let's get it in here and look at it. I'd like to see it again, Mr. Foreman.
The foreman looks at him questioningly and then gets up and goes to the door. During the following dialogue, the foreman knocks, the guard comes in, the foreman whispers to him. The guard nods and leaves, locking the door.
We all know what it looks like. I don't see why we have to look at it again. What do you think?
The gentleman has a right to see exhibits and evidence.
Okay with me.
This knife is a pretty strong piece of evidence, don't you agree?
I do.
The boy admits going out of his house at 8 o'clock after being slapped by his father.
Or punched.
He went to a neighborhood store and bought a switch knife. The storekeeper was arrested the following day when he admitted selling it to the boy. It's a very unusual knife. The storekeeper identified it and said it was the only one of its kind he had in stock. Why did the boy get it? As a present for a friend of his, as he says? Am I right so far?
Right.
You bet he's right. Now listen to this man. He knows what he's talking about.
Right. Next, the boy claims that on his way home, the knife must have fallen through a hole in his coat pocket, that he never saw it again. Now there's a story, gentlemen. You know what actually happened. The boy took the knife home, and a few hours later stabbed his father with it, and even remembered to wipe off the fingerprints.
The door opens, and the guard walks in with an oddly designed knife with a tag on it. Number four gets up and takes it from him. The guard exits.
Everyone connected with this case identified this knife. Now, are you trying to tell me that someone picked it off the street and went to the boy's house and stabbed his father with it just to be amusing?
No, I'm saying that it's possible that the boy lost the knife and that someone else stabbed his father with a similar knife. It's possible!
Number four flips open the knife and jams it into the table.
Take a look at that knife. It's a very strange knife. I've never seen one like it before in my life, and neither had the storekeeper who sold it to him.
Number eight reaches casually into his pocket and withdraws an object. No one notices this. He stands up quietly.
Aren't you trying to make us accept a pretty incredible coincidence?
I'm not trying to make anyone accept it. I'm just saying it's possible.
And I'm saying it's not possible.
Number eight swiftly flicks open the blade of a switch knife and jams it into the table next to the first one. They are exactly alike. There are several gasps and everyone stares at the knife. There's a long silence.
What are you trying to do?
Yeah, what is this? Who do you think you are?
Look at it, it's the same knife.
Quiet, let's be quiet.
Where did you get it?
I got it last night in a little junk shop around the corner from the boy's house. It cost $2.
Now listen to me, you pulled a real smart trick here, but you proved absolutely zero. Maybe there are 10 knives like that, so what?
Maybe there are.
The boy lied and you know it.
He may have lied. Do you think he lied?
Now that's a stupid question. Sure he lied.
Do you?
You don't have to ask me that. You know my answer. He lied.
Do you think he lied?
Number five can't answer immediately. He looks around nervously.
I don't know. Now, wait a second. What are you, the guy's lawyer? Listen, there are still 11 of us who think he's guilty. You're alone. What do you think you're going to accomplish? If you want to be stubborn and hang this jury, he'll be tried again and found guilty, sure as he's born. You're probably right. So what are you going to do about it? We can be here all night. It's only one night. A man may die.
Number seven glares at number nine for a long while but has no answer. Number eight looks closely at number nine, and we can begin to sense a rapport between them. There's a long silence. Then suddenly everyone begins to talk at once.
Well, whose fault is that? Do you think we went over it again? What I mean is...
Did anyone force him to kill his father? How do you like him? Like someone forced him.
Perhaps this is not the point.
No one forced anyone, but listen.
Look, gentlemen, we can spitball all night here.
Well, I was going to say, just a minute, some of us have got better things to do than just sit around in a jury room.
I can't understand a word in here. Why do we all have to talk at once?
He's right, I think we ought to get on with it. Number eight has been listening to this exchange closely.
Well, what do you say? You're the one holding up the show.
I've got a proposition to make.
We catch a close shot of number five, looking steadily at him as he talks. Number five, seemingly puzzled, listens closely.
I want to call for a vote. I want 11 men to vote by secret ballot. I'll abstain. If there are still 11 votes for guilty, I won't stand alone. We'll take in a guilty verdict right now. Okay, let's do it.
That sounds fair. Has everyone agreed? They all nod their heads. Number 8 walks over to the window, looks out for a moment, and then faces them. Or pass these along. The foreman passes ballot slips to all of them. And now number 8 watches them, tensely, as they begin to write. Fade out. Act 2. Fade in on the same scene, no time lapse. Number 8 stands tensely, watching as the drawers write on their ballots. He stays perfectly still as, one by one, they fold the ballots and pass them along to the foreman. The foreman takes them, rifles through the folded ballots, counts 11, and now begins to open them. He reads each one out loud and lays it aside. They watch him quietly, and we all hear his voice and the sound of number 2 sucking on a cough drop. Guilty, 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 guilty. He pauses at the 10th ballot and then reads it. Not guilty. Number 3 slams down hard on the table. The foreman opens the last ballot. Guilty.
How do you like that?
Who was it? I think we have a right to know.
Excuse me, that was a secret ballot. We agreed on this point, no? If the gentleman wants it to remain secret... What do you mean? There are no secrets in here. I know who it was. What's the matter with you? You come in here and you vote guilty, and this slick preacher starts to tear your heart out with stories about a poor little kid who couldn't help becoming a murderer. So you change your vote. If that isn't the most sickening...
Number 5 stares at number 3, frightened at his outburst. Now hold it.
Hold it? We're trying to put a guilty man into the chair where he belongs. And all of a sudden we're paying attention to fairy tales.
Now just a minute.
Please, I would like to say something here. I have always thought that a man was entitled to have unpopular opinions in this country. This is the reason I came here. I wanted to have the right to disagree. In my own country, I'm ashamed to say that.
What do we have to listen to now? The whole history of your country?
Yeah, let's stick to the subject. I want to ask you what made you change your vote.
There's a long pause as number 7 and number 5 eye each other angrily.
There's nothing for him to tell you. He didn't change his vote. I did. Maybe you'd like to know why.
No, we wouldn't like to know why.
The man wants to talk.
Thank you. This gentleman chose to stand alone against us. That's his right. It takes a great deal of courage to stand alone, even if you believe in something very strongly. He left the verdict up to us. He gambled for support, and I gave it to him. I want to hear more. The vote is 10-2.
That's fine. The speech is over. Let's go on.
Foreman gets up, goes to the door, knocks, hands the guard the tag switch knife, and sits down again.
Look, buddy, I was a little excited. Well, you know how it is. I didn't mean to get nasty. Nothing personal.
Number 5 looks at him.
Look, supposing you answer me this. If the kid didn't kill him, who did? As far as I know, we're supposed to decide whether or not the boy on trial is guilty. We're not concerned with anyone else's motives here. Guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. This is an important thing to remember.
Everyone's a lawyer. Suppose you explain what your reasonable doubts are?
This is not easy. So far, it's only a feeling I have. A feeling. Perhaps you don't understand.
A feeling? What are we going to do? Spend the night talking about your feelings? What about the facts?
You said a mouthful. Look, the old man heard the kid yell, "I'm going to kill you." A second later, he heard the father's body falling, and he saw the boy running out of the house 15 seconds after that.
That's right. And let's not forget the woman across the street. She looked into the open window and saw the boy stab his father. She saw it. Now, that's not enough for you.
It's not enough for me. How do you like him? It's like talking into a dead phone.
The woman saw the killing through the windows of the moving elevated train. The train had 5 cars, and she saw it through the windows of the last 2. She remembers the most insignificant details.
Cut to close shot of number 12, who doodles a picture of an L train on a scrap of paper.
Well, what have you got to say about that?
I don't know. It doesn't sound right to me.
Well, supposing you think about it, lend me your pencil.
Number 12 gives it to him. He draws a tic-tac-toe square on the same sheet of paper in which number 12 had drawn the train. He fills in an X and hands the pencil to number 12.
Your turn. We might as well pass the time.
Number 12 takes the pencil. Number 8 stands up and snatches the paper away. Number 3 leaps up.
Wait a minute.
This isn't a game.
Who do you think you are?
All right, let's take it easy.
I've got a good mind to walk around this table and belt him one.
Now please, I don't want any fights in here.
Did you see him? The nerve, the absolute nerve.
All right, forget it. Don't mean anything.
How about sitting down? This isn't a game. Who does he think he is?
He lets him sit down. Number 8 remains standing, holding the scrap of paper. He looks at it closely now and seems to be suddenly interested in it. Then he throws it back towards number 3. It lands in the center of the table. Number 3 is angered again at this, but number 4 puts his hand on his arm. Number 8 speaks now, and his voice is more intense.
Take a look at that sketch. How long does it take an elevated train going at top speed to pass a given point?
What has that got to do with anything?
How long? Guess.
I wouldn't have the slightest idea.
What do you think? About 10 or 12 seconds, maybe? I'd say that was a fair guess. Anyone else?
I would say about 10 seconds, perhaps.
About 10 seconds.
All right. Say 10 seconds. What are you getting at?
This. An L train passes a given point in 10 seconds. That given point is the window of the room in which the killing took place. You can almost reach out of the window of that room and touch the L, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, let me ask you this. Did anyone here ever live right next to the L tracks? I have. When your window is open and the train goes by, the noise is almost unbearable. You can't hear yourself think.
Okay, you can't hear yourself think. Will you get to the point?
The old man heard the boy say, "I'm going to kill you." And 1 second later, he heard a body fall. 1 second! That's the testimony, right? Right? The woman across the street looked through the windows of the last 2 cars of the L and saw the body fall, right? The last 2 cars.
What are you giving us here?
An L takes 10 seconds to pass a given point, or 2 seconds per car. That L had been going by the old man's window for at least 6 seconds, and maybe more, before the body fell, according to the woman. The old man would have had to hear the boy say, "I'm going to kill you," while the front of the L was roaring past his nose. It's not possible that he could have heard it.
What do you mean, sure he could have heard it?
Could he?
He said the boy yelled out, "That's enough for me."
I don't think he could have heard it. Maybe he didn't hear it. I mean, with the L noise.
What are you people talking about? Are you calling the old man a liar?
Well, it stands to reason.
You're crazy. Why would he lie? What's he got to gain?
Attention, maybe.
You keep coming up with all these bright sayings. Why don't you send one into the newspaper? They pay $2.
Number 8 looks hard at number 3 and then turns to number 9.
Why might the old man have lied? You have a right to be heard. It's just that I looked at him for a very long time. The seam of his jacket was split under the arm. Did you notice that? He was a very old man with a torn jacket, and he carried 2 canes. I think I know him better than anyone here. This is a quiet, frightened, insignificant man who has been nothing all his life, who has never had recognition, his name in the newspapers. Nobody knows him after 75 years. That's a very sad thing. A man like this needs to be recognized, to be questioned and listened to and quoted just once. This is very important.
And you're trying to tell us he lied about a thing like this just so it could be important?
No, he wouldn't really lie, but perhaps he'd made himself believe that he heard those words and recognized the boy's face.
Well, that's the most fantastic story I've ever heard. How can you make up a thing like that? What do you know about it?
I speak from experience.
There's a long pause, and the foreman clears his throat. All right, is there anything else? Number 8 is looking at number 9. Number 2 offers the foreman a box of cough drops. The foreman pushes it away.
Anybody want a cough drop?
All right, come on, let's get on with it.
I'll take one.
Number 2 almost gratefully slides him one along the table.
Thanks.
Number 2 nods, and number 8 puts the cough drop into his mouth.
Now, there's something else I'd like to point out here. I think we proved that the old man couldn't have heard the boy say, "I'm going to kill you." But supposing he really did hear it. This phrase, how many times has each of you used it? Probably hundreds. If you do that once more, Junior, I'm going to murder you. Come on, Rocky, kill him. We say it every day. This doesn't mean that we're going to kill someone.
Wait a minute. The phrase was, "I'm going to kill you." And the kid screamed it at the top of his lungs. Don't try to tell me he didn't mean it. Anybody says a thing like that, the way he said it, they mean it.
And how they mean it.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you really think the boy would shout a thing like that so the whole neighborhood would hear it? I don't think so. He's much too bright for that.
Bright? He's a common, ignorant slob. He don't even speak good English.
He doesn't even speak good English.
Number 10 stares angrily at number 11, and then there is a silence for a moment. The number 6 looks around the table nervously.
I'd like to change my vote to not guilty.
Number 3 gets up and walks to the window, furious but trying to control himself. Are you sure?
Yes, I'm sure.
The vote is 9-3 in favor of guilty.
Well, if that isn't the end, what are you basing it on? Stories this guy made up? He ought to write for American Detective Monthly. He'd make a fortune. Listen, the kid had a lawyer, didn't he? Why didn't his lawyer bring up all these points? Lawyers can't think of everything. Oh, brother, you sit in here and pull stories out of thin air. Now we're supposed to believe that the old man didn't get up out of bed, run to the door, and see the kid beat it downstairs 15 seconds after the killing? He is only saying he did it to be important? Did the old man say he ran to the door? Ran, walked, what's the difference? He got there. I don't remember what he said, but I don't see how he could run.
He said he went from his bedroom to the front door. That's enough, isn't it?
Where was his bedroom again?
Down the hall somewheres. I thought you remembered everything. Don't you remember that?
No. Mr. Foreman, I'd like to take a look at the diagram of the apartment. Why don't we have them run the trial over just so you can get everything straight, Mr. Foreman?
I heard you. Foreman gets up, goes to the door during the following dialogue. He knocks on the door. Guard opens it. He whispers to the guard. The guard nods and closes the door.
All right, what's this for? How come you're the only one in the room who wants to see exhibits all the time?
I want to see this one, too.
And I want to stop wasting time.
If we're going to start wading through all that nonsense about where the body was found, then
we're not. We're going to find out how a man who's had 2 strokes in the past 3 years and who walks with a pair of canes could get to his front door in 15 seconds.
He said 20 seconds.
He said 15.
How does he know how long 15 seconds is? You can't judge that kind of thing.
He said 15. He was very positive about it.
He's an old man. You saw him. Half the time he was confused. How could he be positive about anything?
Number 3 looks around sheepishly, unable to cover up his blunder. The door opens and the guard walks in carrying a large pen and an ink diagram of the apartment. It is a railroad flat. A bedroom faces the L tracks. Behind it is a series of rooms off a long hall. In the front bedroom is a diagram of the spot where the body was found. At the back of the apartment, we see the entrance into the apartment hall from the building hall. You can see a flight of stairs in the building hall. The diagram is clearly labeled, and included in the information on it are the dimensions of the various rooms. The guard gives the diagram to the foreman. This is what you wanted? That's right, thank you. Guard nods and exits. Narate goes to the foreman and reaches for it.
May I?
Foreman nods. Narate takes the diagram and sets it up on a chair so that all can see it. Number 8 looks it over. Several of the jurors get up to see it better. Number 3, number 10, and number 7, however, barely bother to look at it.
Do me a favor. Wake me up when this is over. All right. This is the apartment in which the killing took place. The old man's apartment is directly beneath it and exactly the same. Here are the L tracks. The bedroom, another bedroom, living room, bathroom, kitchen, and this is the hall. Here's the front door to the apartment. And here are the steps. Now, the old man was in bed in his room. He says he got up, went out into the hall, down the hall to the front door, opened it, and looked out just in time to see the boy racing down the stairs. Am I right?
That's the story.
15 seconds after he heard the body fall.
Correct.
His bed was at the window. It's 12 feet from his bed to the bedroom door. The length of the hall is 43 feet, 6 inches. He had to get up out of the bed, get his canes, walk 12 feet, open the bedroom door, walk 43 feet, and open the front door, all in 15 seconds. Do you think this is possible?
You know it's possible.
He can only walk very slowly. They had to help him into the witness chair. You make it sound like a long walk. It's not.
Narate gets up, goes to the end of the room, and takes 2 chairs. He puts them together to indicate a bed.
For an old man who uses canes, it's a long walk.
What are you doing?
I want to try this thing. Let's see how long it took him. I'm going to pace off 12 feet the length of the bedroom.
You're crazy. You can't recreate a thing like that. Perhaps if we could see it, this is an important point. It's a ridiculous waste of time. Let him do it.
Hand me a chair. All right, this is the bedroom door. Now, how far would you say it is from here to the door of this room?
I'd say it was 20 feet.
Just about. 20 feet is close enough. All right, from here to the door and back is about 40 feet. It's shorter than the length of the hall, wouldn't you say that? A few feet, maybe.
Look, this is absolutely insane. What makes you think you can recreate a thing like that?
Do you mind if I try it? According to you, it's only going to take 15 seconds. We can spare that.
He walks over to the two chairs now and lies down on them.
Who's going to watch with the second hand? I have. When you want me to start, stamp your foot. That'll be the body falling. Tie me from there.
He lies down on the chair.
Let's say he keeps his canes right at his bedside, right? Right! Okay, I'm ready.
They all watch carefully. Number two stares at his watch, waiting for the second hand to reach 60. Then, as it does, he stamps his foot loudly. Number eight begins to get up. Slowly he swings his legs over the edge of the chairs, reaching for imaginary canes, and struggles to his feet. Number two stares at the watch. Number eight walks as a crippled old man would walk, toward the chair which is serving as the bedroom door. He gets to it and pretends to open it.
Speed it up! You walk twice as fast as that!
Number eight, not having stopped for this outburst, begins to walk the simulated 40-foot hallway.
This is, I think, even more quickly than the old man walked in the courtroom.
If you think I should go faster, I will.
He speeds up his pace slightly. He reaches the door and turns now, heading back, hobbling as an old man would hobble, bent over his imaginary canes. They watch him tensely. He hobbles back to the chair, which also serves as the front door. He stops there and pretends to unlock the door. Then he pretends to push it open.
Stop! Right. What's the time? 15, 20, 30, 31 seconds, exactly.
31 seconds.
Some of the jurors ad-lib their surprise to each other.
It's my guess that the old man was trying to get to the door, heard some word racing down the stairs, and assumed that it was the boy.
I think it's possible. Assumed? Now listen to me, you people. I've seen all kinds of dishonesty in my day, but this little display takes the cake. Tell him, will you?
Number four sits silently. Number three looks at him, and then he strides over to number eight.
You come in here with your heart bleeding all over the floor about slum kids and injustice while you make up these wild stories and you've got some soft-hearted old ladies listening to you. Well, I'm not. I'm getting real sick of it. What's the matter with you people? This kid is guilty. He's got to burn, and we're letting him slip through our fingers here.
Our fingers? Are you his executioner?
I'm one of them.
Perhaps you'd like to pull the switch.
Oh, for this kid? You bet I like to pull the switch.
I'm sorry for you.
Don't start with me.
What it must feel like to want to pull the switch.
Shut up.
You're safe.
Shut up.
You want to see the boy die because you personally want it, not because of the facts.
Shut up.
He lunges at number eight, but is caught by two of the jurors and held. He struggles as number eight watches calmly.
Let me go. I'll kill him. I will kill him.
You don't really mean that you'll kill me, do you?
Number three stops struggling now and stares at number eight. All the jurors watch in silence as we fade out. Act three. Fade in on the same scene, no time lapse. Number three glares angrily at number eight. Number three is still held by two jurors. After a long pause, he shakes himself loose and turns away. He walks to the windows. The other jurors stand around the room now, shocked by his display of anger. There is silence. Then the door opens and the guard enters. He looks around the room. Is there anything wrong, gentlemen? I heard some noise. No, there's nothing wrong. He points to the large diagram of the apartment. You can take that back. We're finished with it. The guard nods and takes the diagram. He looks curiously at some of the jurors and exits. Jurors still are silent. Some of them slowly begin to sit down. Number three stands at the window. He turns around now. The jurors look at him.
Well, what are you looking at?
They turn away. He goes back to his seat now. Silently, the rest of the jurors take their seats. Number 12 begins to doodle. Number 10 blows his nose, but no one speaks. Then finally...
I don't see why we have to behave like children here.
Nor do I. We have a responsibility. This is a remarkable thing about democracy. That we are, what is the word? Notified. That we are notified by mail to come down to this place and decide on the guilt or innocence of a man we have not known before. We have nothing to gain or lose by our verdict. This is one of the reasons why we are strong. We should not make it a personal thing.
There's a long, awkward pause.
Well, we're still nowhere. Who's got an idea?
I think maybe we should try another vote. Mr. Foreman?
It's all right with me. Anybody doesn't want to vote? He looks around the table.
All right, let's do it.
I want an open ballot. Let's call out our votes. I want to know who stands where.
That sounds fair. Anyone object? No one does. All right, I'll call off your jury numbers. takes a pencil and paper and makes marks now in one of the two columns after each vote. I vote guilty. Number two?
Not guilty.
Number three?
Guilty.
Number four?
Guilty.
Number five?
Not guilty.
Number six?
Not guilty.
Number seven?
Guilty.
Number eight?
Not guilty.
Number nine?
Not guilty.
Number 10?
Guilty.
Number 11?
Not guilty.
Number 12?
Guilty. 6-6. I'll tell you something. The crime is being committed right in this room.
The vote is 6-6.
Now I'm ready to walk into court right now and declare a hung jury. There's no point in this going on anymore.
I go for that too. Let's take it into the judge and let the kid take his chances with 12 other guys. You mean you still don't think there's room for reasonable doubt? No, I don't.
I beg your pardon. Maybe you don't understand the term reasonable doubt.
What do you mean I don't understand it? Who do you think you are to talk to me like that? How do you like this guy? He comes over here running for his life, and before he can even take a big breath, he's telling us how to run the show. The arrogance of him. Wait a second. Nobody around here is asking where you come from. I was born here. Or where your father came from.
He looks at number seven, who doesn't answer, but looks away.
Maybe it wouldn't hurt us to take a few tips from people who came running here. Maybe they learned something we don't know. We're not so perfect.
Please, I am used to this. It's all right. Thank you.
It's not all right. Okay. I apologize. Is that what you want? That's what I want.
All right, let's stop the arguing. Who's got something constructive to say?
Well, something's been bothering you a little. This whole business about the stab wound and how it was made, the downward angle of it, you know?
Don't tell me we're going to start that. They went over it and over it in court.
I know they did, but I don't go along with it. The boy is 5'8" tall. His father was 6'2". That's a difference of 6 inches. It's a very awkward thing to stab down into the chest of someone who's half a foot taller than you are.
Number three jumps up holding the knife.
Look, you're not going to be satisfied till you see it again. I'm going to give you a demonstration. Somebody get up.
He looks around the table. Number eight stands up and walks towards him. Number three closes the knife and puts it in his pocket. They stand face to face and look at each other for a moment.
Okay. Now watch this. I don't want to have to do it again.
He crouches down now until he is quite a bit shorter than number eight.
Is that 6 inches?
That's more than 6 inches.
Okay, let it be more.
He reaches into his pocket and takes out the knife. He flicks it open, changes its position in his hand, and holds the knife aloft, ready to stab. He and number eight look steadily into each other's eyes. Then he stabs downward hard.
Look how!
He stops short just as the blade reaches number eight's chest. Number three laughs.
That's not funny.
What's the matter with you?
Now just calm down. Nobody's hurt, are they?
No, nobody's hurt.
All right, there's your angle. Take a look at it. Down and in. That's how I'd stab a taller man in the chest. And that's how it was done. Take a look at it and tell me I'm wrong.
Number two doesn't answer. Number three looks at him for a moment, then jams the knife into the table and sits down. They all look at the knife.
Down and in. I guess there's no argument.
Number eight picks the knife out of the table and closes it. He flicks it open and, changing its position in his hand, stabs downward with it.
Did you ever stab a man?
Of course not.
Did you?
All right, let's not be silly.
Did you?
No, I didn't.
Where do you get all your information about how it's done?
What do you mean? It's just common sense.
Have you ever seen a man stabbed?
No.
All right, I want to ask you something. The boy was an experienced knife fighter. He was even sent to reform school for knifing someone, isn't that so?
That's right.
Look at this.
Number eight closes the knife, flicks it open, and changes the position of the knife so that he can stab overhanded.
Doesn't it seem like an awkward way to handle a knife?
What are you asking me for?
Number eight closes the blade and flicks it open, pulls it ready to slash underhanded.
Wait a minute, what's the matter with me? Give me that.
He reaches out for the knife.
Have you ever seen a knife fight? Yes, I have. In the movies? In my backyard, on my stoop, in the vacant lot across the street. Too many of them. Switch knives come with the neighborhood where I lived. Funny, I didn't think of it before. I guess you try to forget those things. Anyone who's ever used a switch knife would never have stabbed downward. You don't handle a switch knife that way. You use it underhanded. Then he couldn't have made the kind of wound which killed his father. No, he couldn't have. Not if he'd ever had any experience with switch knives.
I don't believe it.
Neither do I. You're giving us a lot of mumbo jumbo.
What do you think?
Well, I don't know.
What about you? Listen, I'll tell you something. I'm a little sick of this whole thing already. We're getting nowhere fast. Let's break it up and go home. I'm changing my vote to not guilty.
You're what?
You heard me. I've had enough.
What do you mean you've had enough? That's no answer. I think perhaps you're right. That is not an answer. What kind of man are you? You have sat here and voted guilty with everyone else because there are some theater tickets burning a hole in your pocket. Now you have changed your vote for the same reason. I do not think you have the right to play like this with a man's life. This is an ugly and terrible thing to do.
Now wait a minute. You can't talk like that to me.
I can talk like that to you. If you want to vote not guilty, then do it because you are convinced that this man is not guilty. If you believe he is guilty, then vote that way. Or you don't have the guts to do what you think is right?
Now listen.
Is he guilty or not guilty?
I told you, not guilty.
Why?
I don't have to.
You have to. Say it. Why?
They stare at each other for a long while.
I don't think he's guilty. I want another vote.
Okay, there's another vote called for. I guess the quickest way is a show of hands. Anybody object? All right. All those voting not guilty, raise your hands. Numbers 2, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 11 raise their hands immediately. Then slowly, number 12 raises his hand. Borman looks around the table carefully, and then he too raises his hand. He looks around the table, counting silently. 9. All right, all those voting guilty? Numbers 3, 4, and 10 raise their hands. 3. All right, the vote is 9-3 in favor of acquittal.
I don't understand you people. How can you believe this kid is innocent? Look, you know how those people lie. I don't have to tell you. They don't know what the truth is. And let me tell you, they...
Number 5 gets up from the table, turns his back, and goes to the window.
Don't need any real big reason to kill someone either. You know, they get drunk and bang, someone's lying in the gutter. No one's blaming them. That's how they are. You know what I mean? Violent.
Number 9 gets up and does the same. He's followed by number 11.
Human life don't mean as much to them as it does to us. Hey, where you going? Look at these people are drinking and fighting all the time. If somebody gets killed, so somebody gets killed. They don't care. Oh, sure. There are some good things about them, too. Look, I'm the first to say that.
Number 8 gets up, and then number 2 and number 6 follow him to the window.
I've known a few who are pretty decent, but that's the exception. Most of them, it's like they have no feelings. They can do anything. What's going on here?
Foreman gets up and goes to the windows, followed by number 7 and number 12.
I'm speaking my piece and you listen to me. They're no good. There's not a one of them who's any good. We better watch out. Take it from me. This kid on trial...
Number 3 sits at the table toying with a knife. Number 4 gets up and starts for the window. All have their backs to number 10.
What don't you know about them? Listen to me. What are you doing? I'm trying to tell you something.
Number 4 stands over him as he trails off. There's a dead silence. And number 4 speaks softly.
I've had enough. If you open your mouth again, I'm going to split your skull.
Number 4 stands and looks at him. No one moves or speaks. Number 10 looks at him, then looks down at the table.
I'm only trying to tell you. All right, sit down, everybody.
They all move back to their seats. When they're all seated, number 4 then sits down.
I still believe the boy is guilty of murder. I'll tell you why. To me, the most damning evidence was given by the woman across the street who claimed she actually saw the murder committed.
That's right. As far as I'm concerned, that's the most important testimony.
All right, let's go over her testimony. What exactly did she say?
I believe I can recount it accurately. She said that she went to bed about 11 o'clock that night. Her bed was next to the open window, and she could look out of the window while laying down and see directly into the window across the street. She tossed and turned for over an hour, unable to sleep. Finally, she turned toward the window at about 12:10, and as she looked out, she saw the boy stab his father. As far as I can see, this is unshakable testimony.
That's what I mean. That's the whole case.
Number 4 takes off his eyeglasses and begins to polish them. They all sit silently watching him.
Frankly, I don't see how you can vote for acquittal. What do you think about it? Well, maybe. I mean, there's so much evidence to sift.
What do you mean, maybe? He's absolutely right. You can throw out all the other evidence.
That was my feeling.
Number two, polishing his glasses, squints at the clock, but can't see it. Number six, watches him closely.
What time is it?
6:10.
It's late. You don't suppose they let us go home and finish in the morning? I've got a kid with mumps. Not a chance.
Pardon me. Can you see the clock without your glasses?
Not clearly. Why?
Oh, I don't know. Look, this might be a dumb thought, but what do you do when you wake up at night and want to know what time it is?
What do you mean? I put on my glasses and look at the clock.
You don't wear them to bed?
Of course not. No one wears glasses to bed.
What's all this for?
Well, I was thinking, you know the woman who testified that she saw the killing wears glasses? So does my grandmother. So what?
Your grandmother isn't a murder witness.
Look, stop me if I'm wrong. The woman wouldn't wear her eyeglasses to bed, would she?
Wait a minute. Did she wear her glasses at all? I don't remember.
Of course she did. The woman wore bifocals. I remember this very clearly. They look quite strong.
That's right. Bifocals. She never took them off.
She did wear glasses. Funny, I never thought of it.
Listen, she wasn't wearing them in bed, that's for sure. She testified that in the midst of her tossing and turning, she rolled over and looked casually out the window. The murder was taking place as she looked out, and the lights went out a split second later. She wouldn't have had time to put on her glasses. Well, maybe she thought that she saw the boy kill his father. I say that she only saw a blur.
Now, how do you know what she saw? Maybe she's farsighted.
He looks around. No one answers.
How does he know all these things?
There is silence.
Does anyone think there's still not a reasonable doubt?
He looks around the room, then squarely at number 10. Number 10 looks down and shakes his head no.
I think he's guilty.
Does anyone else?
No. I'm convinced.
You're alone.
I don't care whether I'm alone or not. I have a right.
You have a right.
There's a pause. They all look at number 3.
Well, I told you I think the kid's guilty. What else do you want?
Your arguments.
They all look at number 3.
I gave you my arguments.
We're not convinced. We're waiting to hear them again. We have time.
Number 3 runs to number 4 and grabs his arm.
Listen, what's the matter with you? You're the guy. You made all the arguments. You can't turn now. A guilty man's going to be walking the streets a murderer. He's got to die. Stay with me.
I'm sorry. There's a reasonable doubt in my mind.
We're waiting.
Number 3 turns violently on him.
Well, you're not going to intimidate me. I'm entitled to my opinion. It's going to be a hung jury, that's it.
There's nothing we can do about that, except hope that some night, maybe in a few months, you'll get some sleep. You're all alone. It takes a great deal of courage to stand alone.
Number 3 looks around at all of them for a long time. He sits silently, waiting for him to speak, and all of them despise him for his stubbornness. Then suddenly, his face contorts as if he's about to cry, and he slams his fist down on the table.
All right.
Number 3 turns his back on them. There's a silence for a moment, and then the foreman goes to the door and knocks on it. It opens. The guard looks in and sees them all standing. The guard holds the door for them as they begin to slowly file out. Number 8 waits at the door as the others file past him. Finally, he and number 3 are the only ones left. Number 3 turns around and sees that they are alone. Slowly, he moves towards the door. Then he stops at the table. He pulls the switch knife out of the table and walks over with it. He holds it in the approved knife fighter fashion and looks long and hard at number 8, pointing the knife at his belly. Number 8 stares back. Then number 3 turns the knife around. Number 8 takes it by the handle. Number 3 exits. Number 8 closes the knife, puts it away, and taking a last look around the room, exits, closing the door. The camera moves in close on the littered table in the empty room, and we clearly see a slip of crumpled paper on which are scribbled the words, "Not guilty." Fade out.
And that was 12 Angry Men. Thank you for listening.